speaker is Alan Bailey. He's going to be talking about quanta and qualia. Thank you, Alan.
Hello, everyone. I hope you can hear me at the back. I will try and talk normally and wave your arms if I'm in order. A big thank you to Tim for arranging this whole occasion and inviting me to join in, and being a very good editor as well, and keeping us all in order as speakers, as you see. So, highly organized, and this is great. But I did think that coming at the end of the day would be a nice chance to kind of round up. But I find that Bob's talk in particular, and the talks in general, have been covering quite a lot of the ground that I thought I might do a ground-clearing job on before I actually tried to answer the difficult question of how the two things, these things, relate. But anyway, I wanted to start with... I have to move this thing on now, didn't I? Yeah, Dennett's way of putting the heart problem. We've talked about it and heard about it before. But I think there are two presuppositions in this way of putting it, maybe not always in what Dennett said, which are worth trying to get rid of and see things that bit differently. The two presuppositions I have in mind are partly that he focuses on things, kinds of things. There are all these kinds of things which are part of the physical world. And then there is another different kind of thing, consciousness. And we have to revise our conceptions, work out the relationship between these two kinds of things. That's one way of putting it that I think is misleading, and we can do better. And the other way is, the other point is that this whole problem is treated as what there is, reality, and how these different parts, aspects, the features of reality relate to each other. When, which is in posh philosophical words, ontology. And I think I want to start from what we know, or how we know these facts about reality, before we work on what we think we know and how it relates. And so epistemology, I want to argue, comes before, and it, logically as well, this issue of what is real. How do we know what is real? So, I can move this thing on. The first point I wanted to make, to question, was this idea that things are the basis of reality. And I put the slogan at the top. It's also the name of a book by Lademan and Ross. Professor Lademan came here a year or so ago, some of you may remember, and was putting roughly the same point. And this is to argue that if you want a philosophy or a metaphysics beyond physics, which explains, which sees reality in such a way that fundamental physics can be related to the special sciences, which are all the way from chemistry, biology, to Ross as an economist and social sciences. And the point this book makes, some length and a good deal of argument, is as you see, that reality is not a sum of concrete particulars, to put matters as simply and crudely as possible. It real patterns all the way down. And to show that this isn't just an eccentric metaphysician, I put in Carlo Rovelli also, from a physicist, the point of view of fundamental physics, saying that things are built by the happening of elementary elements, world of existent things is reduced to a realm of possible interactions. So happenings, patterns, interactions are the best way of seeing reality, which we are then better able to tackle under these two headings. And these, of course, the quanta qualia headings, and these, of course, are treating the still reality in terms of things. So we're talking about experiencings and physical happenings. And this may be helpful in our further discussion, but I think it's rather be taken for granted. We've had events for some part of the time, as well as things of different sorts. So let's move on. The other presupposition I wanted to look at was, as I said, how we know. And this brings us back to, well, Mike was trotting out Mary in her black and white room. She knows what it is like to experience colours when she's finally let out. That knowledge is different from all the knowledge she has or could have about physical facts as they are known currently by current physics or even in this notional example thought experiment, what could be known. And is the basis of the other sacred text I brought with me, which has been the basis for my thinking recently. This is Howard Robinson, who figured in Marianne's talks on the mind-body problem, and his book, From the Knowledge Argument to Mental Substance, that the Knowledge Argument, I'm trying to be able to read my script, get it right. Don't do that in hearing aids. Can't be helped. There we are, the Knowledge Argument. And this is formula. I mean, Mike did a pretty good demolition job on the Knowledge Argument before, but I thought it was interesting just to mention that Howard Robinson formalized it, sort of resurrected it. I think he, as the book says, from the Knowledge Argument, he's starting believing this is a helpful argument. But I read it quickly through. Mary knows all the facts about the perception of colour, which can be in principle be expressed in the vocabulary of physical science. Unlike those who have normal visual experiences, Mary doesn't know what it is like to perceive colour. Therefore, what's like to perceive colour can't be characterised using the vocabulary of physical science. The nature of any physical thing, state or property can be expressed in the vocabulary of physical science. Therefore, what it's like to perceive colour is not a physical thing, state or property. Now, I don't know how this argument strikes you, but as I say, Mike was saw reasons to take it apart and treat it as inconclusive. And I have said in that right that although formalized, this is firstly put in negative terms, what it's like to perceive colour is not a physical thing. So what it's like to perceive colour is something which we experience, which is different from physical things. Indeed, that point is implicit, I think, in the second of his premises at the top. Unlike those who have normal visual experiences, Mary doesn't know what it's like to perceive colour. That implies those who have normal visual experiences do know what it's like to experience colour. And that seems to be begging the question, where does it leave us? Well, I think It leaves us where we were before, finding an unquestionable subjective fact, a piece of knowledge which each of us has, that there is something it is like to be experiencing. I'm reminded of Galen Strawson, who commented somewhere that anyone who doubts the reality of experience, subjective experiences, clearly has never suffered from insomnia. And that seems to be a nice summary, that you can know all too well that you have thoughts going on in your mind without physical stimuli, without knowing the least bit what your neural processes, which are presumably grinding along in your brain, anything about them, you still know very well that you are experiencing. And that it's not just a raw feel either, it is experiencing what it is like. It's a revealing phrase, what it is like. It's not knowing that I am conscious, that I am having experiences. It's I know that I am experiencing thoughts about this and that. Although I talk about thoughts about this and that, if they were propositional thoughts, I know that I am feeling fed up with it, the moods that we are conscious of are just as much a part of experiencing as the propositions or the perceptions. I want to insist that is a way of knowing about reality, and all is a real way of experiencing, which is different in principle from knowing the physical facts, which is, let's say, as Bob was saying, subjective experiencing as against physically observable public facts. I'm probably laboring this argument too hard, because it's pretty well implicit in most of what we've been saying. But it does amount to what I think of epistemic dualism as a label for it. And it requires people to decide whether they are going to take due notice of knowing what it is like as a kind of knowing, which is not always the case. The lady in Ross' book that I mentioned doesn't dismiss experiencing, but it says, on the contrary, that people who wish to explore the ways in which intuitive anthropological conceptual space is structured, in other words, folk psychology, are invited to explore social phenomenology. We, however, are interested in objective truth rather than philosophical anthropology. Introspective anthropology is done all the time. Its expert practitioners are mainly writers of fiction. We don't recommend turning their job over to philosophers. So much sort of subjective. I think that's too quick. I think of it as physicalism by diktat. It's saying you may have all these subjective experiences, but we don't want to know, because we're physicists, and that will be the objective truth, which is good enough. I don't think it's good enough on its own. I don't think Bob was suggesting it was. He's suggesting that you have to relate these two. And that, I think, is the second half of my talk. And I shall see what I can say about it. The hard problem is in those terms, how do subjective experiences and physical phenomena, happenings, relate, and how do we explain their relationship? First thing to point out in terms of their relationship is that perceivings, which are subjective experiences, are also observing physical phenomena. The observing end of it is precisely matching the requirement that observable phenomena, this is your actual observing of physical happenings, which are defined by, their reality is defined by, by definition they are real if they are observable. And I think it's one of the interesting things about these physical facts which is lurking in the discussion is that they have this modal element, as it usually gets called. It's not that they are actually observed, that somebody asked about the world before anybody was there. It's just that they were observable, would have been observed if somebody had been whizzing around in space all the time, whatever. That modal element, I don't think it matches the point about subjective experiences, but there is a parallelism with the fact that subjective experiences are not just raw feels, but are experiences where you know what it is like to be having something happening in your consciousness. You know that you're seeing a colour, and when another picture comes up, you can see whether it's the same colour. So it is, again, experiences with recognisable qualities. Qualia are treated as things, this is happening, this is experiences of what it is like. And that relationship of what Locke called similarity, same word, same concept of likeness, two colours are alike, is a crucial feature of how we observe the physical world. Another point I want to make, I'm doing some of my script but going off it a bit. One of the other points which are about the close relationship between the two streams or processes of that we are talking about knowing, one of the key points is, again, Bob was referring to it, of matching each of them. Each side has a before and after ordering, so that there are processes, they aren't just in separate happenings, they are one or after the other. And similarly in the physical world, there are objective facts about the passage of time, measurable time, public time, which are complicated by relativism and all that, but I don't need want to go into any of that. It's just that we do correlate our subjective sense of time with the objective series of happenings by every time we look at a watch. This, I think, is the sense in which individual tokens of experiencing and particularly perceiving are related to physical events as correlated. They are that is what we mean by saying that they're correlated, that they happen at the same time. If we stick with the tokens on each side. I didn't quite agree with Bob's definitions of correlation versus causation. I think you can make sense of that token-token correlation in sort of way I try to do, but it's not clear to me that you could locally relate types of happenings to types of subjective experiences. You can see that if I get physically hurt somehow, that's correlated with the pain I feel, and when somebody else does something equally silly and contorts their features, you think, oh gosh, he must be feeling pain as well. I mean, feeling a similar pain. And so there are lots of ways of assuming as a probability that it's something like, that a physical happening correlates with a subjective experience. But among physical happenings, there is the possibility of them fitting into types. We had Kripke and so on talking about necessity, but that is, it seems to me, recognizing that things fall into classes, and that indeed is how we identify them, how we learn the words for them. And that is why, actually, built in the language, there is this structure of subject and property, of subject and predicate, substance and property, and that is a standard structure of, so to speak, atomic facts. But in any case, in terms of physical happenings, kinds of happenings, types of happenings, is reflected in the way we name things and talk about things. Then the question is, how far can we make physical, make subjective experiencings fall into similar types. In a broad sense, clearly we can, but this is where I want to distinguish between correlation and strict causation. Strict causation is about 100% law-like regularities in the phrase. The causation in terms of a sufficient elements in a necessary, there is a Gormando phrase for it, both sufficient sets of necessary conditions, got it. And that law-like regularity, where if the things don't match, you know there must be something else which explains the difference, is, it seems to me, not just very difficult to apply on the subjective side of it, even on the physical side. If we're talking about brain neurology, as Pannon was doing, and these 86 billion neurons, it's pretty difficult to produce law-like regularities among all that lot and all their correlations. But when you're trying to match some set of physical happenings with what's going on, what you're experiencing individually yourself. It seems to me in principle impossible to pin down the type subjective experiencing, which would fit into a law-like regularity and give you a right to call this strict causation. We work in terms of probabilities, and are happy with that both ways, from my deciding to do something to moving on or whatever. And we work with probabilities all the time through psychology. But that is different from saying giving a causal explanation. So I'm skirting around this question of how the two sides are related. And I do think I've also got to say that not only causation seems to be difficult to apply to this relationship, but there is the essential subjectivity that we're talking about a sequence of experiencings. They are experiencings which belong to one experiencer, a Frege, no experience without an experiencer. So the hostility to thinking in terms of things isn't so easy to apply when you're thinking about somebody experiencing this sequence of subjective experiences. I don't want more to say about that. Like Hume, I can't say that there is a self there that I can detach from the experiences, but just to say there is a bundle of experiences which happen not to be quite the same as any other experiences that may be happening elsewhere in the room, it's not good enough. We have to say that they are my experiences. And the other asymmetry, which is not true of physical happenings, and the other asymmetry is that we do all often talk in terms of agency, of paying attention to, deciding and initiating movements and saying things and so on. And so we are treating ourselves as agents, which gets us into this question of whether a computer has agency, and it's not easy to see how it could be said to do so. It's been told, given the rules, and it's flying them. But that's another area where I think is where anyway asymmetry seems pretty plausible to me. But you may say that all this is picking up incidental features, or anyway, it's still skirting around the main problem, which is that to explain the relationship is the basic reason why we have these two ways of knowing and how to understand the relationship between them. One trouble is if you want an explanation between two streams of data or something, you look for a familiar analogy. You say, well, it's like, I haven't got an example to trade off, but the explanation in terms of the unfamiliar in terms of the familiar, it is a standard way of doing things, of it making it, producing it. Plausible explanation. But in this case, there can't be anything more familiar than having experiencing and finding ourselves dealing with tables and chairs and all the physical standard facts about the world. So I don't think you can expect an explanation to be like that. And I do think the explanations, the familiar ones, suffer in a sense from that difficulty. Emergence we've had quite a lot of this afternoon, and it sounds, as in the Chalmers quote I had at the beginning, something arising out of something else. And it's tempting to say, well, that must be the physical, the public, the verifiable, the objective, and subjective consciousness, perceptions, experiencings arise out of the physical facts, the brain activity, whatever. But as Cullen was saying, there are all kinds of things which can be said to emerge from other things, and on its own, that doesn't seem to me to amount to much sort of an explanation. there are other. We've had epiphenomenal words. Physical. There are physical happenings, and the subjective experiences are just somehow incidental, going on without affecting physical causation, which is in itself, it seems to me, inescapable. If I'm right that causal links between subjective experiences and physical happenings, strict causal links, are in principle impossible, I mean unidentifiable, and don't make sense because you can't have sufficiently defined subjective experiences, then in a sense they are epiphenomenal if you believe that the physical events, even brain events, are proceeding on comprehensive, complete causal laws. I think that's questionable, but that's another issue where I find it in free will as well as all this. But going hastily back on track, the only move, so to speak, left, which I think is worth acknowledging, pursuing, and indeed that was what Mike was saying, is some kind of anomalous monism where you say, well, there are different descriptions, but we're really talking about the same thing, which it sounds all right and it has a good deal of philosophical respectability, but it strikes me as still going beyond what we know. We know how we establish physical facts about happening, and how we observe, experience subjective feelings, thinkings, perceivings in ourselves or as subjects. But when you say, but there must be something behind, something common, in common between how you're feeling and what's going on in your brain, and that must be neither one thing nor the other, but some deeper reality, it sounds to me too much like the Kantian thing in itself, which is not, it seems to me, respectable if, like me, you take a radical empiricist position, which has a long history. It goes back way beyond Frank Jackson or anyone of that ilk, to Locke and Hume and scientific enlightenment. And that reliance on empiricism strikes me as particularly a British phenomenon, or way of approaching it, And I finish with avoiding anomalous modism. William of Ockham, entities are not to be multiplied beyond necessity, beyond what we actually know.
Thank you very much, Alan. Questions, please, in the usual way. Put your hands up, and Tim, you were going to go next.
Thank you. I thought I was following you for a while, and then I think I lost you, and then I think,
Sure.
So this is sort of a question to clarify things as well. I was disturbed by a number of things you said, because I come to this from a scientific perspective. And I thought I heard you say that there were certain things we could be certain of, and that you talked about 100% law-like irregularities. Well, I mean, as a scientist, one of the initial points that you make is that we really are certain of very little. We really know very little. Yeah. And that an awful lot of what we do is subject to a whole row of assumptions. Yeah. And then that is the reason why we're so reluctant to claim causality. Because, when I hit that, it makes a noise. But I can't say for absolutely certain that wouldn't have made a noise without my seeing it.
I accept that. I see that notion of strict causality as a working hypothesis. We were looking for a way of establishing it or trying to falsify it in order to make a better shot at the idea is that there is something there to establish.
Yes.
I agree, this other things being equal kind of clause, and as you say, the whole scientific agnosticism, so to speak, wait and see if anybody's got a better idea. It's all part of science, sure.
And what made me most upset was the idea of there being an objective truth, because I really don't believe that there's an objective truth. There's so much evidence that truth is a movable feast.
Well,
a scientific perspective and not a philosophical perspective, perhaps.
I think I want to answer on similar lines. You never are sure if you've reached a final truth, but that's still the target. You believe that there is a truth out there to be established, or most people, most of the time, seem to work on the basis that there is a truth to be established. And so I by all means qualify that as near enough acceptable.
What worries me a little bit about that is that if you do say that there is a truth to be established, it does invite somebody to say, yes, but I have the truth, you don't have it, and then we...
Well, then it's a question whether you've got a better explanation, a better founded public array of facts to support what you believe to be the case. And I thought you were going to say that 100% law-like regularities are not precisely how modern physics works. It works with what I was reading out from Ledner and Ross, relations between data points and the kind of theoretical constructs you can make. But in order for the constructs to be qualified as real, I think I'm still safe in saying that you have to be able to show that they are, if not directly observable, indirectly observable by instruments, inferable from observation, somehow tied to observable facts.
As long as one is prepared to accommodate the fact that bridges do fall down and airplanes fall out of the sky.
Well, there we are. We all make mistakes.
Thank you.
Do you have another question for Alan? Anybody else
want
to ask another question?
Oh, good. I'm not cutting into drinking time.
Well, in that case, shall we continue on in the bar with discussions with all the wonderful talks that we've had. Dinner will be served at 7 p.m. If you're not sure whether you've signed up for dinner or not, come and see either myself or Tim or Stuart. We've all got the list of who's there. And I hope you have a wonderful dinner, and we look forward to seeing you back tomorrow morning here at 9:30 a.m.